Welcome to a special Tuesday edition of The Week in Russia, RFURL's weekly podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and for those of you who may have just joined us now, my guest this week is Nigel Gould Davies. Nigel is the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He was the British ambassador to Belarus from 2007 to 2009, and has also been the head of the economic section at the British Embassy in Moscow. So a wealth of experience in this region. Thank you very much for joining me today, Nigel.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
All right. It's great to have you. Now, I normally ask the guests two questions on this podcast. For the first one today, I want to focus on an article of yours, Nigel, that was published in the journal Foreign Affairs just a few days ago. The headline is "The Astonishing Endurance of Unity on Ukraine." Now, it's been over a year since Russia's large-scale invasion, and you wrote that, quote, "the West's commitment to Ukraine is undiminished and, measured by aid delivered, stronger than ever." You continued, "this unity is unprecedented and underappreciated, and it far surpasses the strongest periods of transatlantic cohesion during the Cold War." And you wrote that despite this perhaps unexpected unity, those are my words, I think, Russian President Vladimir Putin still believes the West will weaken before Russia does. This is his potential path to victory, perhaps his only one, following the setbacks that Russia has suffered on the battlefield so far. But what I want to focus on is not the unity up to now, but the future. In the article, you set out four ways for the West to maintain this level of unity, four things Western countries can do to try to sustain it. Can I just ask you to give us a rundown, kind of explain these four recommendations and explain why you believe they're crucial?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Steve. So in order to do that, I will just need to sort of glance back at the argument about unity. Because the four things that we must do follow from that argument. So, I mean, really, I wanted to write the argument to explain what I thought was this underappreciated fact that Western unity has up to now. We mustn't be complacent, of course, and I'll say more about that a little later. But unity up to this point has been stronger and more emphatic than Western unity in regard to the Soviet Union was during the Cold War, and even during the darkest and tensest moments of the Cold War. And just to illustrate that with one example, so I think most people would say the Soviet Union appeared at its most dangerous in the late 1970s, early 1980s. It had at least achieved strategic equality, possibly superiority in some respects with the United States. It had a very, very large conventional military superiority in Europe. It was installing a new generation of intermediate range nuclear weapons in Eastern Europe to hit Western targets very quickly. It was very, very menacing. It was a genuine superpower. So you'd think that was a moment that will weld the West together. And yet we find, even in those sort of semi-crisis times, very significant Western divisions. The United States had sought to respond at European request, it has to be said, to the new generation of Soviet nuclear weapons by deploying Pershing 2 and cruise missiles. They're opposed by large sections of Western European populations. There were huge demonstrations against them, fierce criticisms of official policy in several countries. Also, at an official level, there were very significant divisions over energy policy. The United States wanted to stop the Soviet Union building a gas pipeline to Western Europe. Western Europeans were very, very unhappy with that. Even Margaret Thatcher, who was Ronald Reagan's closest ally. So, again, even these darker days, you have splits and divisions and some real bitterness in some cases. None of that today, none of that since the invasion has begun. Yes, there's been wobbles and as I put it in the article, spats, but not splits across the transatlantic alliance. And not only has the West remained unified, it has rapidly escalated the forms of support it's providing to Ukraine and also the extent of the sanctions that it is imposing on Russia. That's reached quite unprecedented levels, including invention of completely new sanctions instruments like the oil price cap. So seen in historical perspective, we should be impressed by the extent of resolve and the degree of its practical expression in support for Ukraine, where in a series of issues, the unthinkable has quickly become the doable. The tank debate is just the latest example of that. So again, we mustn't be complacent, but I think we should take a degree of pride and satisfaction in that unity. It's certainly not something that could have been assumed from the start. It's certainly not something that Putin expected or intended. He is still counting, part of his theory of victory, still counting on the West's unity and resolve breaking up sooner or later. So from the past to the future, what are the things that the West must do to sustain this unity? And the first is to constantly maintain the correct understanding that any outcome to this war that leaves Russia better off than it was before this latest invasion began would not fundamentally resolve the conflict. It would not only be immoral to, in effect, reward Russian aggression, it would be horrifically immoral as well with respect to the Ukrainian population that would become permanently captive to Russia. Because when you cut lines across maps, it's not just territory, it's peoples that you are dividing. But there is a deep rational self-interest, strategic self-interest for the West in ensuring that this aggression is not rewarded. It would set a terrible precedent for others in the world. They're watching very closely at the story of Western resolve here and looking for signs of weakness and compromise that could be exploited in other times and places. But in addition to that, there's no evidence at all that an end to the fighting that left Russia better off would be, in any sense, a long-term resolution. It would be much more likely a pause and a prelude to a further invasion by Russia, a further act of aggression against a now weakened Ukraine. It would lead, in effect, to a third invasion after the first of 2014 and the second of 2022. So there is, for all those reasons, there's a strategic self-interest, a security case for maintaining resolve. In addition to that, there is the moral case as well. And we've all been horrified by the revelations of ongoing war crimes, not sort of episodic and individual, but systematic in scale. Wherever Russian forces have occupied Ukrainian territory, they have carried out war crimes. It is part of their system, if you like. So we have a situation here where strategic self-interest and moral obligation and compulsion are pulling in the same direction, reinforcing one another to a degree that we haven't seen in the recent past. So, and that means continuing to bear witness, document these crimes, and set into motion the international legal processes, which would lead to eventually to holding individuals to account. And there's already processes that are set to begin in The Hague, the International Criminal Court. That's welcome and important. The third thing, and the fourth thing, actually, together, that the West must do to sustain unity, not only remind ourselves keep constant in the front of our minds that the strategic and moral cases are strong, but also ensure that on the home front, resolve does not weaken. So that means, thirdly, making sure that the malign economic consequences for the world, and including for our own populations, that they do not lead to any erosion of resolve. We've had higher commodity prices, of course. That's in particular hurt our poorest citizens. Commodity price inflation means that low incomes are stretched even more tightly. We don't want that to happen. We don't want that to cause a critical mass of the population in any country to begin to reevaluate our support for Ukraine. So this is sort of a domestic policy issue, but it means there are different ways to do it, and different countries are exploring this. Targeted subsidies, various forms of domestic welfare support to the poorest citizens. I would argue it's right to do that anyway, but there is now a strategic case for doing so. So making sure that Putin's manipulation of the grain price crisis, for example, doesn't cause us to rethink these things. And Russian propagandists on television have been very explicit in hoping that the lack of access to Russian energy and higher food prices will indeed lead to a collapse of Western support. This has been very explicitly articulated as part of their plan. So there's a domestic, inward-focused dimension of our overall strategy here. And the fourth and final thing to do is to make sure that the way that our populations think about and frame this war remains solid and strong. Russia is a subtle and skilled practitioner of disinformation. We've seen it sow its malign seeds in the Western information space, including at times of elections in the past. I think we can take heart up to this point, since the war began, that capacity has been harmed, that Russia, at least in the West, is losing the information war. But again, there's no room for complacency here. We must continue not to take that for granted, but to sustain the right narratives and indeed extend them to other parts of the world where the Russian voice and Russian deception, frankly, seems to carry further. And I'll just I'll stop on this point, Steve, but just the final bit of news that's just in, which caught my eye and caught yours as well. So I think it was yesterday, Fox News interviewed or sent questions to a number of potential Republican candidates for the presidency and asked about their attitudes towards the Russia-Ukraine war. And others were certainly troubled by some of the answers there that were given that suggested that if at least some of these people became president, we might see a different attitude in the United States. And this is after 2024. And this is an alarming prospect. The West has passed a series of electoral tests so far since the war began. Elections in Italy and Sweden changed governments, but they did not change Ukraine policy. In France, President Macron was re-elected against the challenge of Marine Le Pen, whose party is known to have ties with the Kremlin. But the biggest worry looming is the challenge in Washington next year. I was at a meeting with Boris Johnson just yesterday, and he made this very clear as well, actually. And he said it's very, very important that the political class, that the bipartisan support for Ukraine and in resisting Russia remains strong through the next election.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Nigel. This is a little unfair. I'm going to ask two questions, but I'm actually going to ask a second question that's following up on what you've just said, including the portion that you just articulated about the U.S. elections coming up and how that may be the biggest challenge. The question is about your point three, the idea that the United States and its allies must develop, I think you put it in the article, must develop domestic policies to sustain their commitment to Ukraine. And So my question is kind of twofold. Are there precedents for this in the past? And also whether you think it's realistic given the deep divisions in some Western countries. And as you mentioned, you know, maybe this is not answerable right now, but the elections seem to be presenting a challenge, you know, with some politicians certainly saying that defending Ukraine is not a priority.
So I don't yet see deep divisions, at least political divisions, on these issues in Western countries. And in some ways, that's a welcome surprise, as it were, because so many political issues in recent times have been sort of contaminated by a polarization, and extreme vilification of the adversary camp. We've seen this on a whole range of questions related to the pandemic, for example, and vaccines and all of these things. Strange myths arising, sort of toxic polarization setting in. We saw plenty of this sort of thing around the 2020 election in the United States as well. But there seems to be a sense in which moral clarity has returned to public politics across pretty much all of Western societies. And it's this unanimity, again, which I want to return to, because it is a striking counterpoint to again, even the tensest moments of the Cold War. So it's all Western states, except Hungary, you have to say that, all Western societies, and in large majorities still, supporting Ukraine, and large parts of the private sector. And that is genuinely new as well, and I think a surprise. That's parts of the private sector and big companies as well, you know, with decades of experience in Russia, billions of dollars of investment commitments, have not only complied with state sanctions, because they have to, because it's the law, they've also voluntarily reinforced them by, in many cases, withdrawing from Russia. There are different views, depending on what study you look at, of what proportion of Western businesses have done that. But it seems to be substantial. And certainly, again, some of the biggest names that one couldn't have assumed would do this have withdrawn. So I don't think you see deep divisions. In terms of the domestic policies to sustain support, yeah, I think we saw some of this during the Cold War, when generally levels of, I'm not going to get too tangled up with sort of domestic policies, although I'll leave that to the experts on that front. Though, you know, make the larger point, it is all connected in a sort of a grand strategy that must attend properly to the connections between foreign and domestic policy. But just make this point. During the Cold War, when the Soviet threat was greater, the threat of its ideas was a little different. They claimed to have a better economic model. Of course, they didn't, but that was their claim. That was part of their attraction. Western governments did offer a degree of welfare support and protection, in part because they didn't want the false claims and false attraction of an alternative economic model to gain influence within Western societies. So you had sort of levels of welfare provision and support, which in many cases sort of hollowed out or stripped away or reduced in the post-Cold War period, in the period of, as it were, more naked economic liberalism. The challenge for Russia now is of a different order. No one thinks Russia isn't even pretending that it has a better economic model. That's not obviously not the challenge at all. The challenge economically is a different one, that Russian manipulation of access to commodities and therefore commodity prices might put pressure on Western populations, particularly poorer citizens, and cause them to become disillusioned by Western support for the war. They might begin to demand a different sort of policy calculus and say, well, look, you know, we care about our own nutrition, our own welfare, more than we care about Ukraine. That's not happening yet, but we want to make sure it doesn't happen. But maybe the solution isn't so different from what Western governments did during the Cold War. You need targeted assistance. You need proper welfare policies. You need to make sure that people are kept out of poverty as a consequence of this war. So I draw a broad analogy there if you're asking for precedents for welfare policy today in the previous era of our confrontation with Russia.
All right, thanks very much. That's very fascinating, and it takes me back to the 70s. But as you say, the challenge quite different, and in some ways more severe now. My other question that I wanted to ask is related to your first recommendation of what the West must do to sustain support, unity, and support for Ukraine. The idea that, as you wrote, any end to the war that leaves Russia in a position to renew its campaign against Ukraine poses a long-term threat to vital Western interests, unquote. And when you were on this program last May, we talked about a New York Times guest essay in which you had argued that it was crucial for the West to, quote, guarantee that Russia is worse off than it was before the invasion. And you touched on this again today. At a minimum, you said Western policy should ensure that Russia gains no new Ukrainian territory and continues to face severe sanctions until it fundamentally changes its policy toward Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And you also warned that to wait for a grueling stalemate to define the contours of a peace settlement is to favor Russia, unquote. Now, my question today is, is that still possible to make sure that Russia doesn't end up in a better position than it was at the start of the invasion? It certainly seemed possible at times, maybe many times last year, following successful Ukrainian counteroffensives in the east and south and also in the north in the initial weeks when Ukraine beat back Russia's advance on Kyiv. And so at these times, Kyiv certainly seemed to have the momentum, but neither side has made major gains more recently, despite very intense fighting around the Donbass city of Bakhmut and elsewhere, mostly in the Donbass. But has the war reached a stalemate?
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, a couple of points there. Firstly, I think no one really expected that there would be a major breakthrough in recent months. This has been the winter after all. And Ukraine had, as you recall, made major gains and very significant and unpredicted breakthroughs around Kharkiv and Kherson in the autumn. And Russia had been pushed back into what at the time were more sustainable positions. So no one expected at that time, I think, that momentum would continue in the short term. But going back to that point, that no one also had expected very few people, those major breakthroughs in the autumn. That drives home the larger lesson that this war has been intrinsically unpredictable. There were much discussion of stalemates last summer, and one began to hear these arguments. Yes, it's going to be slow and attritional and grinding and World War I-like. And so it was until it suddenly wasn't. So I would say we cannot be confident that we can predict the course of this war, even in the coming few months, let alone the next year. Although I would say we're looking at the tail risks on either side. I don't see any great risk at this point that Ukraine will become significantly worse off. I'd suggest that most of the risks lie on the Russian side. And this brings me to sort of a second point, but a larger point, to return to the fundamental issue of Western resolve and make the comparison again with the Cold War. So in long wars, when both sides are all in, so it's really, a fundamental importance to them and not peripheral or limited importance, if they're really all in, it's a long war. The lesson of history is that the economically stronger side always wins. And that makes perfectly good sense, of course, because if your economy is larger, especially if it's significantly larger, then you just have a larger resource base on which to draw in providing the weapons needed to fight that war. The sinews of military power are just thicker and stronger. That's the lesson of long wars. So let's compare the situation now. What does it look like? Basically, compared with the past. During the Cold War, which you can think of as a decades-long contest of economic systems as much as anything, the collective West, which is the North American Western Europe, was about 2 to 2.5 times wealthier than the Soviet Union Eastern Europe. And yes, you can sort of argue a bit about the figures and you know, how exactly you measure Soviet-type economies and non-market systems and so on, but roughly speaking, 2.5 times bigger. What happens if you do the calculation today? You compare North America with pretty much all of Europe now, so you know Britain and the EU, and now on the other side of the ledger, it's just Russia. Do the math there, and the West is over 12 times as wealthy. And for many, that will be a significant understatement, actually. And that's 12 times, that's if you make the calculation according to purchasing power parity, because, of course, there are different ways of comparing national income. So that's the way that's most generous to Russia. Say, at least, West is at least 12 times richer, probably more so. Again, when I made this point to Boris Johnson yesterday, his eyes popped, and he said he's only 12 times. But yes, at least 12 times. So the point there is if the West retains its resolve and is willing to turn a larger proportion of its economic superiority into militarily usable form to Ukraine, and no one is asking the West to fight directly, that provide the tools to Ukraine with the West's much bigger economy and also qualitatively much more sophisticated technologies, this, you know, there's no doubt who will prevail in this. That's the point. So I see in this imbalance of economic capacity, both a message of hope and also a reason to sustain our commitment.
All right. Thanks very much. That's really extremely useful, at least for me, kind of explanation. And I would say, I mean, you suggested that Boris Johnson's eyes popped because he thought 12 times was less than he would have expected. But to me, it seems like my eyes were popping a bit because, you know, it's a large amount. So your arguments there are, you know, very interesting. We're getting short on time. We don't have a lot of time left, but we do have time for a few questions, I think, or a couple of questions if there are any. So I'd invite people to use one of the methods to ask a question if you have one.
Steve, if we're waiting for someone to ask a question, could I just make one point quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't see any questions yet. Please go ahead.
Okay, yeah, just touching on an observation you made earlier about the consequences of the if Russia were to end the war better off, especially significantly better off than it was before this invasion began. It's important to understand why this would be a disastrous outcome for the West and why it would be worse now, significantly worse, for the West if Ukraine lost than it would have been if Ukraine had been defeated immediately in the first days or weeks of the invasion, as Putin expected. It would be worse now because if Ukraine had been quickly defeated and occupied, that would have been a humiliation and a setback for the West. The West would become significantly, strategically worse off. It would have presented this sense of Putin again being master of the game and be able to make these rapid moves and catch other people off balance. That would have been bad. But if something similar were to happen now, then Putin will have achieved a victory after the West has repeatedly committed itself in rhetoric and in policy to preventing that happening. So it would be a matter not only of the West becoming strategically worse off, it would be a matter of the West's credibility around the world being shattered, frankly. Because others, you can think of China, for example, would see this and say, once again, the West loses its nerve. All you have to do is be tough enough for long enough, and whatever the West says, and even what it does, it ultimately has no stomach for a fight. And I think that if that is the outcome and that is the conclusion that others draw, then that would be absolutely disastrous for the West, would have global consequences for the indefinite future.
Yes, I mean, I definitely see what you're saying. Just to not that it's not clear at all, but just to elaborate on your point there, you know, I think at the beginning, you know, there was a lot of expectation that Ukraine would frankly, you know, lose quickly. So, you know, as you say, I think that would be something that would be quite horrifying and embarrassing and bad. Would have been, you know, for the West, obviously for Ukraine, kind of the idea, well, Putin made all these demands of the West and Ukraine, NATO and the U.S., and then he went in and tried to get them by force, to fulfill them by force. And had that succeeded, obviously would have been a huge blow. But now when you have, you know, as you said, what the West is saying and doing, officials saying Russia can't win, that this is not something that can be allowed to happen, and also all the aid and weapons. So, you know, I can see your point that an outcome in which Russia ended up better off would be even worse and significantly worse, perhaps, than it would have been in the beginning, at least for the West and areas beyond Ukraine. So it's also, you know, a good argument, I think, for as you say, kind of this sustained unity, and coupled with the point about the, you know, economic superiority of the West. It almost sounds like a no-brainer, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, just wait a few moments, see if anyone has emerged with a question. Okay, sometimes we have several. Today looks like I don't see any questions.
I'll make one more point then.
Absolutely.
So coming back to the threats to Western resolve. Again, elections are always moments when things can change. And I mentioned earlier, a series of European election challenges, tests have been passed so far. And we are all worried about what will happen in November 2024 and America. And that's really a striking change because, again, during the Cold War, the general worry was that if transatlantic unity split fatally, it would be a consequence of something happening in Europe and not something happening in America. It might be an election in West Germany, for example, or it might be an election in Italy, or, you know, possibly in Britain when the Labour Party adopted an anti-nuclear policy in the early 1980s. The question of American resolve and commitment to both supporting Western Europe and also opposing tyranny in Eastern Europe, that was never in question. And now the positions are reversed. What we worry about most is a continuing resolve in the United States. And that's a kind of historical reversal, it seems to me, and one that, you know, one that is worrying, of course, but one that deserves more attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, that kind of reversal had its roots a few years ago. But, Yeah, I mean, it's a very seems like a big challenge ahead. I'm just going to thanks very much for setting everything out so clearly, Nigel. I'm just going to give like a few moments in case a question pops up, but we are getting short on time. So, if not, I will wrap it up here. Again, Nigel, thanks. Very, very, very clear. Lots of food for thought, and you know, some kind of heartening points, I would say, but also, you know, a good explanation of the challenges that are faced. So, thanks for joining me, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much.
All right, great to have you. Now, once again, I've been speaking to Nigel Gould-Davies, the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, former British ambassador to Belarus, and a high-level diplomat posted in Moscow. My name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which is published on Fridays. Thanks for listening.